around the globe, there's so many interesting people. I love that idea of being able to bring in, you know, whether it's coaches or caddies or people of interest, some of the people from the special force, corporate leaders, or whatever it is that you fancy, you can build that into the experience. Along with this golf, then you have these cool evenings where you sit around and maybe drink some wine, conversations, and change the way you see the world. An event like that could conceivably be transformational and actually change your life if it's done right.
Welcome to The Spin, brought to you by the Confederation of Professional Golf, the one-stop golf podcast fueling your hunger for eye-opening conversations and industry insight, and offering backstage passes to the inner mechanics of the global game.
So, welcome to this episode of The Spin-off, my regular monthly podcast that I tend to get some interesting people from the world of golf and have a chat about things that are relevant to the golf industry, to the golf business, and to PGA pros across that. And today I'm really lucky to be sat here. We're sat just right of the 18th green at TPC Sawgrass for the Players' Championship, and I'm with the 2019 PGA of America Teacher of the Year and regular, I think since 2013, top 100 teacher in the US's golf magazine, Kevin Kirk. Kevin, welcome.
Ian, thank you so much for having me on. I love your office, man.
Yeah, it is certainly a great office, but the clouds have come over, which is not right for Florida. Kevin, let's start with, obviously, you're well known for the achievements you have and the people you coach, but just give us an insight into Kevin Kirk and your mindset and philosophy.
I think probably for me, I mean, I got into the golf business as a failed player, which is, you know, a lot of us do. I mean, I had played as a young person and had achieved a relative amount of success through my amateur career. I went to the U.S. college golf system and had success there. And so in my mind, it justified me pursuing golf professionally for a while. So I did that for about 6 years. Woke up one day and realized that for whatever reason, I couldn't get myself organized well enough to play at the level that I was trying to kind of play at. So I took a year away from the game trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, because I had no B plan at that point in time. And over the course of that year, I had some time to reflect on the game and kind of myself and what I wanted to be in the world. And I decided to kind of move back into golf from a coaching perspective. So that would have been 1990, so this is my 32nd year doing it. So I've been at it a while. But I would say that, you know, for me, I think I've been really a lifelong learner in golf. I mean, I'm fascinated by the game. I'm fascinated by the things that it teaches us, the things that it teaches me about myself, it teaches me about the world. And so I think probably from a philosophical perspective, I think probably the approach I would use is more of a Kaizen approach, which is, you know, the philosophy of continuous improvement that the Japanese had for years and years. And so So every day I wake up and I'm just trying to kind of figure out how to, you know, how to get a little bit better at things and try to, you know, find out a little bit more. And in Kaizen, the great thing about it is there's, you know, there may be a whole lot of things that are kind of seem like they're kind of going well, but there's usually one or two things that you're a little bit unsettled about that you need to dig into. And so, you know, when I wake up in the morning, it's about being able to celebrate those things that are going well, but also be able to kind of dig into those things that they're making me uncomfortable, but I want to try to get better at. So.
Yeah, and you've taken that kind of holistic approach to your coaching and into your coaching philosophy. Yeah,
I mean, I think you start looking at coaching, in particular when you're trying to help other people, you have to look at the totality of who they are. They're not just, you know, their TrackMan information. They're human beings. They've got big golf stories. They're fascinating to have somebody tell you their golf story. I mean, every time I start with a new client, it's like, tell me your golf story. And it's just unbelievable, these stories people tell, right?
Yeah.
And then so, you know, the other part of that is, I mean, you've got, you know, they've got body, minds, and spirits that you have to tend to. And if you're really going to be helpful and transformational and try to help move people forward, it's, I can't imagine trying to do it without taking a broader look at it.
Absolutely. But coupled with that, and you mentioned, you know, TrackMan analytics, etc., you've also been a huge advocate of data and statistics and analytics. So how do you combine the two?
I try to be adaptive in the world. You know, I think the idea is, you know, we can shun technology, say, oh gosh, I'm an old school coach and I don't want to mess with it. But the truth is the matter is that, you know, all this new technology is coming to us it's, you know, it's like a toolbox. Each one of those tools could potentially help me get better, or, you know, can help me gained some information or a way to communicate that I didn't have before. I'm not probably the most tech savvy person, but I do embrace it. I'm not afraid of it. When I see new technology that I think potentially help me, I will lean into it. And I don't feel like I have to be an expert at all the technology. It's okay for me to outsource that and find people for example, biomechanics. I mean, the biomech reports are mind-bending to try to look at them. But if you find somebody like Mark Bowles, a good pal of mine, I can have him come do a capture and he can say, okay, this is what this is telling him. And then use that, to start making some decisions or try to avoid injury, whatever we're going to do with it. So I do think the use of technology is important. I do think we are in an interesting time because I do think there's a new generation of coaches that have become over-reliant on it. I do think at the end of the day, coaching is an art form. I do think that it requires, it's really about being competent, able to actually have a competent coach. And so competence is not often discussed in today's world. But just look out here on the PGA Tour, you look at around the world at good coaches, they are, more than anything else, above all things, they're competent. And so I think what we should be kind of seeking in our industry and the development of young coaches is competence. And trying to define what that means from a matrix perspective. What are the 10 or 11 different lanes that they would require of competence, right? And if we can create that, we can create a generation of coaches that can not only carry forward all the cool things that have happened up to this point, but they can also start thinking about what's ahead.
Yeah.
And start trying to kind of get ahead of that. Because, we all have to be thinking about not what's happening, today, but we also have, what's this going to look like 10 years from now?
And so how do you link that to, I guess, again, you're famous for taking the money ball approach I think Kirk Metrics is the word. How do you take that matrix and then apply it to the individual from an analytical perspective?
The cool thing about golf is that, that particularly at a higher level, there's now enough data available where we kind of know what good is for different levels of player. We know how to benchmark a player for different scores. So, for example, if somebody's trying to break 80, there are benchmarks that are associated with that in terms of different off the tee or approach shots around the green and on the green. And I can tell you that my coaching got a lot better when I started introduce that earlier in the process. Because a lot of times, let's use Jim Furyk, for example. I love Jim Furyk. And I love Jim Furyk because he's like a huge outlier in my mind. Now, Jim Furyk is, probably if you look at him from a playing player's perspective of his era, it'd be hard to argue that he's not one of the top players of his era, right? He's won majors, all the Ryder Cups and President's Cups teams. He's broken 60 twice. He's had an incredible career. And if you watch Jim Furyk play golf, nothing looks like golf, right? Yet he's competent. He is so competent. So I can promise you, if he were to come to me as a young player, and I had not been able to kind of figure out his competence level first by using, I would have ruined him for sure, because there were so many things there that you would point to and say, we can't do that. But I do think, if we can start with, okay, if somebody's competent already, then my job is not, I don't have to put my fingerprints all over and change just because I don't like the way it looks. And so it allows for a more organic approach, less invasive, right? And I do think that, if we're trying to kind of help people play better golf, some people want style. If that's the case, then that's great. Mm. But if somebody just wants to play better golf, we have to know what those benchmarks are. So for me, once I figured out that there's tools available to do that, it changed my life. Absolutely changed the way I thought the world. And I would tell you that if you're not using some sort of benchmarking with your players around competence first, I think you're potentially putting yourself and them at risk. So I love it. I mean, there are certain analytics that I'm more attracted to than others. Shots gained is interesting, but it's not what I use. So you use players' benchmarks against their own level. What it is they're trying to do. So, I think sabermetrics and analytics in that space relative to performance is really, really important.
Yeah, and I guess you'll see that with some of the leading players you've coached. I mean, Graham McDowell, Lexi, and even Patrick Reed, unusual golf swings, but have maximized their...
So the thing you have to kind of look at, particularly with high performance players, is by the time they've gotten to me, they're already good. And there's a lot more I can do to mess them up than to help them. So I have to be, you have to be super careful with that. So a lot of it is taking time to understand the player, are they good enough at these different levels, right? So I'll take you through a story on Lexi. So I was asked to kind of help Lexi Thompson out, and the people around her said she's a terrible putter. Okay, so I went to see her. I ran her through kind of confidence test, beautiful off the tee, iron play good. Her wedge play is from, let's say, 120 to 30, not good. She couldn't chip at all. And so the things that were, and then I ran her through a putting test and she aced it. So I was like, Lexi, you're not a bad putter. You're putting too far from the hole, because when you chip it, instead of chipping it to 3 or 4 feet, you're chipping it to 10 feet. And every time you get a wedge in your hand, instead of hitting it in the, inside your, you know, your proximity numbers, you know, you're hitting it too far away from the hole. And then with an iron, you're so afraid that you're gonna, you know, that you can't chip, so you end up hitting it 40 feet to the right of the hole. So basically with her, it was really just reorganizing her thoughts about her game and her practice and the way she was gonna try to kind of go about her game. During that time period, we took her from, I think, fourth or, you know, fifth or sixth in the world to number two doing that by just simply reorganizing her thoughts about what she was doing. Very little technical. It seems to me that if we start thinking about golf in terms of trying to help people, start with competence first. If somebody's competent, then it's my job is to simply understand how they do that and try to make that a little bit better. And I think if we could do the same thing with club players, I think our impact on them is much more positive.
Sure.
Right? Because going through a big swing change or changing technique or changing equipment, the time there's required to adapt, most people can't do it. It was interesting. I mean, she missed a couple short putts, and, you know, obviously we all do. We saw Jim Rahm miss one from a foot last week, right? So it happens. But the problem is for these high-profile players, they're on a stage. They do it on a big stage, and all of a sudden, everybody thinks that they're a bad putter. But when I tested her, and I had her, you know, do a short putt test and long putt test, she performed. Based on the test, I did it a couple different times. Her putting performance was actually above. She'd been the positive on strokes gained on the tour. So, but her in her mind, she's a bad putter.
I would have thought exactly the same, looking at Lexi, and I guess the commentators are not fully informed on this as well, because they would probably say the same, that short putting, etc., would have been her weakness. Well, we've moved inside because one of the downsides of the balcony on my office is the blowers are going outside, clearing the 18th green. Just moving on from that a little bit, I see on your arm very proud Olympic rings from 2021, and you've represented or worked with five Olympians, and I think another part of you is, you've talked about is how learning from, you know, high performance in whatever area of and across sports, I guess the Olympics provided just a fantastic opportunity for that.
You know, I've always been fancied, you know, Olympic sport in any form, really. To see the sacrifices that these young people make to their sport, to their country, and how far they're willing to push themselves to go wrap themselves in their flag and go compete. And so I've always been fascinated by it. I've had the great luxury of being around a lot of different coaches that coach some of these different sports. And I will tell you that one of the things that I think we need to be thinking about in golf is being able to kind of use some of this cross-pollination from these different groups and, you know, people that are good in other areas. Because I think, you know, in golf, it's a bit myopic. There's not much about golf that we don't know. But so for us to get better, we have to have some new thoughts from maybe some other different sports or different leaders or, you know. And I think that probably as we start looking at our education of ourselves and the people that are in the business, in the industry, this cross-pollination is where the growth comes from. I've learned so much from being around the Olympic coaches, other athletes, other sports. So when golf came back to the Olympics, I couldn't believe it. I was so excited. And we had a bunch of kids in our program were training, and a bunch of cool stories there. So five of them went off, and this last go-round, we had another two or three that were kind of competing. And by just this crazy stroke of serendipity and luck, or whatever you want to call it, I get a call the Saturday before they're supposed to tee it up in Japan, the Olympics. I get a call from Patrick. He says, DeChambeau's tested positive for COVID. I'm in, and my caddy can't go. you're the only other person in my on my team that can go. Do you want to go caddy? I said, of course I want to go caddy. So I get over to the Olympics. I'm so excited to be there. You know, we got a chance to kind of, you know, see some of the Olympic Village things. We got to do, you know, but the big thing was when I strapped that bag on, right? I am now by definition Olympian. I was 60 years old when that happened. Okay. It wasn't like I was 25. Yeah. So I fancied this thing my whole life. Loved watching all the different things that Olympic sports and all of a sudden I find myself actually on the arena in the stage. I didn't really think much about it when it was going on, but when I got back, I got a letter from the Olympic Committee that said, you know, congratulations on your participation in the Olympics. And I started thinking about, you know, something that was maybe one of the coolest things I've ever seen. I will tell you, there were a couple things that happened that week that I will never, ever forget. But the biggest one was, there was two things. Number one, it was how happy people were to be there. And regardless of the sport or their involvement, you get the sense that these people, the amount of sacrifice that the athletes had made, that the amount of sacrifice that these countries had made to make sure these athletes were there, and the appreciation that everybody has to be there to compete. I've never seen anything like it anywhere. And the second thing is these people kind of started competing in the golf competition. The last medal, there were seven people in one playoff. And these are some of the best players, golfers in the world. And I have never seen people more in tune and attentive. It was so competitive, I mean, but it wasn't about the money. It was simply about, I want to get up on that stage. I mean, it was unbelievable. I really believe that this golf event in the Olympics is going to gain more and more steam as it goes along. I can tell you, I've been to all the Ryder Cups. I've been to the President's Cups. I've been to all the majors. I've seen a lot in golf, but my experience there is going to be in the top two or three things that I've ever had a chance to experience. Yeah. So yeah, I came back and I thought about it for six months and a couple months ago, about a month ago, I said, exactly. Oh, the hell with them.
And the next one is at Le Golf National, home of the 2018 Ryder Cup. So yeah, okay. I think, and players love that golf course.
I fell in love with that place. I mean, we got our hat handed to us there. We got beat up pretty bad, but the golf course is fabulous. The people were amazing.
I'm
the culture.
With you.
There's a lot to like about that. That should be a great venue.
In running our organization, I always try and look into other sports and the way that other sports are run and how leaders run these other sports. And I guess it's just it's the same principles for high performance.
High performance, I mean, I've had the chance to spend some time around a lot of people in the high performance domain. And one of my good friends is a guy named Commander Mark McGinnis. And he's basically is a commander and trainer of Navy SEALs. And so he's lived that high performance culture. I think the Special Arms Forces really around the world are probably some of the best high performance teams on the planet. So there's a lot to learn from them, and it's amazing the principles that he talks about that hold true in his space are very. I mean, there's this massive overlap in terms of what it's required to play good golf and to be good at anything. You know, so whether it's corporate culture, whether it's golf, whether it's special forces, I mean, there is a big, huge overlap of principles that I think we can all be looking at. If we're not, I think we're being silly.
In golf education, because we do tend to look at it, and we put golf pros and golf coaches together, and they're not with coaches from other sports, managers from other sports, pros from other sports. As I say, I'm a huge advocate that you can learn so much from being in that environment.
We all know enough about golf and golf coaching. If you don't know anything, pick up your phone, turn it on, and you can search anything. So the days of acquiring information in the old way, where you had to go find somebody, you had to listen to what they had to say or read about it, you know, process the information. That's all needs. Today, if you need some information, you pick up your phone and you access it via, you know. But if we're talking about information that we don't know much about, it seems to me that one of the best things, if we had coaching summits going forward, should be about a quarter golf and about three quarters this other stuff, where you bring people from these other experts, these other high performance people in, that are interesting as hell, by the way, and let them speak to us about how they think, how do they approach things. I just feel like that if we have to be kind of taking
the mindset of shifting tactics and
figure out how we're going to move some of that.
While, how do you take that kind of the matrix, I suppose, that you're using in high performance with Patrick and Lexi, etc., to beginners, to juniors, to developmental golf? How do you take those principles?
One of the best things that happened to me as I moved along, there was a period of time in my life where I got off into triathlon in a pretty big way.
Right.
And I spent probably 10 years as a competitive triathlete, and I never did any Ironmans, but I was a very competitive Olympic distance racer. I would do 5 races a year, so I would have done 50 of them. And during that time period, one of the things that was fascinating to me was the amount of sports science around cycling and swimming and running, which, you know, it was like because those were Olympic sports. So it was just shortly after the millennium, there was a triathlon conference at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. So we went up there, and this guy gets up there and makes his presentation. His name is Isvan Bali. Isvan Bali was the guy who coined and developed the philosophy of long-term athlete development. And I had never seen anybody do it, but he got up there and spoke, and I could immediately recognize, okay, this guy, he's got it. Because I went up and introduced myself just right after his presentation. And it turns out he's rolled out these developmental pathways for like 25 different sports in 50 different countries. So I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. So I started to spend some time with him, you know, trying to find out, trying to learn more. So he really helped me understand how these developmental pathways kind of lay out. Some of it's age, some of it's skill. And it's interesting, the things that you use in early development with young kids are the same things we have to do to reskill seniors who've become de-skilled through their lifestyle. So you've got this, there's an incredible body of information about long-term athlete development. And the good news is most of the golf federations around the world that I'm in contact with have at least adopted, or at least, you know, they at least understand it's there.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, trying to run a big program without having some sort of pathway and understanding that long-term athlete development philosophy and how to manage people as they move down the pathway, I just don't think it's going to have the robustness that it's going to need. I think adding that element is such a huge advantage. And for me, that's been my playbook.
A huge part of our organization is
20 years.
That sharing of knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, don't feel you need to, in any country, start from scratch with this.
No.
You know, it's take the best bits from what people are doing elsewhere and apply them to your situation.
Yeah, what applies here? What
we're also very keen on helping young PGA pros,
matrix, right?
Sharing your knowledge, that 30-odd years of experience that you've had. You're on the PGA of America Teaching and Coaching Committee. You know, is that something you love doing? It's that feeling of being able to give back to the association and other pros?
Yeah, I think, you know, just another part of my probably philosophy is I want my work to be first transformational, and the second part of it is transactional. So I understand that I have to make a living at it, but I also want the things that I do to actually make a difference. So out here in the high performance space, is that, you know, making a difference is helping them play better golf, right? But in terms of outside of this tour thing that we do out here, you know, the rest of it is developing players, developing coaches, and developing opportunities for myself and others, right? If I can help broker some sort of better business opportunity for any of my colleagues around the world, I'm happy to do that. I want people to have opportunity. Right? So for me, that feels good to me, right? It feels like that my work is actually impactful. It's actually having a positive value. And so, yeah, I mean, I look for opportunities all day long, every day, to be able to do that. But one of the things that drove me away from playing is how self-centered it was. My nature is actually much more of a collaborator than a competitor. I love collaborating. I love doing whatever I can to help either another player, another coach, another organization, whatever it's going to be, to try to help them. I mean,
we talk about elite coaches,
that's also
in my mind, you're a coach of an elite player. You can be an elite coach no matter whether you're coaching tour pros or you're coaching kids. You can be an elite coach at coaching kids. You can be an elite participation coach, whatever it is. What words of advice would you give to a young pro starting out and forging their career?
I think that probably the most, if looking across the the landscape and seeing people that I know that have done it, there's a few common things that you'll see, but one of them is they're very intentional. So they start with this idea of looking at a spectrum of possibility and trying to figure out what it is they want to do, and they have the capacity to focus on that one thing and relentlessly work their way towards it. I do think that in today's society, it's easy to bounce around, and if you bounce around too much, you can't get enough experience, enough headway kind of built up on to be able to master your craft. So mastery, you know, look at the mastery models, and let's just assume that you know, some of the stuff that we've been, you know, about mastery in other arenas, you know, they would suggest that it's you know, 10 years, 10,000 hours of training. So I'm sitting here on 30,000 hours, I'm sitting here on 30,000 hours of, you know, probably golf coaching. The further you go down the road, you learn more, you get more experience, you get clearer about what it is, you come up with better questions. But I just can't see that happening in a weekend workshop or a 1 year PGA apprentice program. It requires this long-term, relentless, just waking up every day and working towards that. So, and it's hard to figure it out. I mean, it's okay to change paths, but I don't think it's helpful to bounce around and do.
Obviously, we're seeing greater specialization. We've got short game coaches, we've got et cetera, et cetera. But really, that idea of finding your passion and really committing to it.
Yeah. So I mean, if there were two things on that pathway, there would be intention and mastery. That's it. So if you want to be a master, you have to approach it from a mastery perspective. And that involves trial and error, involves study, involves failure, involves a bunch of things that aren't very pleasant, right? And we've all had it. But if you're able to be able to endure the difficult things on the pathway, you're able to handle some failure, you're able to continue to, you know, keep your intention and focus on mastery.
Right, change of tack, pretty much anything. This is our travel issue of our Insider magazine. You're going to be a big part of the first high performance camp that we're doing with Sports Travel Group in March 2023 in Miami. Come to that one in a second. Before that, and not counting that event, what would be your ideal 5-day coaching trip? Where would you go? What would it consist of?
I think, you know, there's so many great locations around the globe, you know, that you can kind of go to that have access to all the courses, the history. So if you're gonna build one of those, I would think that would have to be part of it. You have to go to a place that you might find interesting, that they've got some history. I also think that if you're gonna do that, starting to weave in some people to kind of come and enhance that experience, people of interest. Because I do think that as you start kind of looking at it, it's, let's say you decided to go to Cabo, let's just give it a place, right?
Yep.
I mean, being able to kind of bring people in that from the culture that are exceptional and interesting. If I'm going to Scotland, I'm going to get on the phone. I'm going to talk, see if I can get somebody from the RNA to come speak to us. You know, I'm going to maybe find a caddy, been around a long time.
Yeah.
If there's one of the tour caddies floating around, I'm calling him, and I'm going to call the shop owner down there to see if he'll come and just have him kind of come in each night and just speak about the culture and about how it is there. Right?
Probably not enough people think about it that way. They're just going for the bucket list courses. They don't need you to go with them for the bucket list courses.
No, exactly right. So. But you can organize, you know, when they go into these places, you know, each night maybe have a little social where they get together maybe for a light meal, but have somebody of interest come in that they can speak with and learn from. And I think to me is that around the globe, there's so many interesting people, right? I mean, to me, I love that idea of being able to bring in, you know, whether it's coaches or caddies or, you know, people of interest or, you know, some of the people from the special forces or corporate leaders or whatever it is that you fancy, you can build these, you know, build that into the experience. So along with his golf, then you have these cool evenings where you sit around, you maybe drink some wine, you have these conversations that change the way you see the world. Because that could, an event like that could conceivably.
March 2023 in Miami, looking forward to that, it's a great deal. It's been put off a few times because of the world circumstances that we've faced. What can we expect from it?
Well, I think, you know, as we move closer and closer, I mean, Miami is a great place. It's one of the great cities. It's right now, it's probably in the U.S. one of the most dynamic cities around. They have great food, great culture, great, it has been tremendous. I mean, the energy around the city is fantastic. The property that the Trump property there is actually fantastic. The courses are amazing. You've got access to pretty much anything that you would want while you're there. The idea is, I've been involved in the conversations, is to try to kind of make it as much like what we just talked about as possible. There's going to be some golf, and the coaches are going to have a chance to kind of have access to us and our group, right? So any questions they might have. But then also see if we can bring some people in that transform the way we think. And so our hope is that these events become things that people desperately want to do, because once they've done one, they go, gosh, you know something? When I left, I'm different. I was different in a good way. So we're working hard to try to make sure we get the right mixture of people. And it's always kind of play, you know, the groups are all different. They all have their own personality. So trying to figure out, okay, what are things that people really want to, are interested in and want to kind of learn about, and try to bolt on some of these other things to, along with, you know, we've all been on golf trips, and we've all kind of been to, you know, to a place and enjoyed the courses, and you know, there's been some coaches around, but I think there's more to it, and my hope is that we can go ahead and try to kind of fill that
The trip will take place at Trump Durrell. You're there on a regular basis.
I am.
Yeah, and a more regular basis now. How do those facilities shape up compared to other?
You know, I think the golf courses are actually very, very good. You know, the famous one's the Blue Monster, but the other three courses are really fantastic. They all have their own personalities. The weather there is normally terrific.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that time of year, very, very struggle with anything but perfect weather.
A lot of our audience, obviously, just coming into the season there.
Yeah, so it's like a preseason event. The hotel and the accommodations and the food and the experience there is amazing. It's probably the easiest thing that you'll ever do. I mean, you get off the airplane in Miami and we're like 12 minutes from the departure gate.
Right.
So it's an easy place to get to. Once you're on site, it's very easy. You'll be very well taken care of. And we're going to go to work on trying to make it an experience that you're never going to forget. You know, it's collectively. The one thing that I always talk to Rick and our staff about is that, you know, we're not really in the golf business. We're in the access business. We have access to things that people want, whether it's information, whether it's technology, whether it's leading to a course, or, you know, whatever it's going to be. So we're trying to create access points to try to, you know, make sure that they get exactly
what they
want. We
talked a lot about experience.
Maybe a couple of surprises
that come along the way. What they're going to take away from this in terms of learnings. Great opportunity to mix with other PGA pros who share similar aspirations. We're also going to be using sabermetrics, something that's new to me. Sabermetrics and analytics. So how will this tech support what they're going to learn from?
Well, I think if the coaches currently aren't using it, it'll give them an introductory course into how it works. We also, in terms of being able to kind of use it, Our thought is going to be to try to kind of use it to help drive the decisions we make internally around the support of the players while they're there. So if we've got a player who's trying to break 90, okay, well, what does that mean, right? And if we've got players who are trying to break 80 or trying to, you know, shoot 70 or whatever it is, we can actually benchmark that for them before they get there. And then while they're there, we can test them relative to those benchmarks and say, okay, what are you already good at? What's going well? What needs working, and what's the plan? It's a much gentler and better way to get people to improve at golf than trying to sit out there and say, okay, you know, Mr. Jones, you're out here and, you know, your club is, you know, I don't like the way your club's moving, and we're going to go to work on changing that. It may require that, but if it doesn't require that, then why are we doing it? If Mr. Jones is already drives in the fairway 85% of the time and hits half the green,
I'm assuming there'll be an element there
of
looking at course strategy and course management as well.
A lot of it has to do with understanding, okay, what in the sabermetrics area, the difference between data and analytics is data is just these data points, right? Analytics is giving these things relevant. Some things are more relevant than others. And a lot of times, one of the things that happens in sabermetrics or in when you start piling data on is you might see a value that might be of concern, but the question is, does it change the outcome? Does it move the needle? So a lot of times it doesn't. And so it's being able to have the wisdom to be able to kind of look through all that and say, you know something, I see that value, I know you're concerned about it, but it's not going to change your outcome too much. So, I'm terrible with my hybrids, but the truth of the matter is, you know, he misses he can't make it from 4 feet, and every time he tries to chip it on the green, he chips it 25 feet. Now, I hear, Mr. Jones, I hear what you're saying, and we'll deal with that later, but if you really want to play better, you got to putt a little bit better, and you've got to chip it better. And I'll talk to you about the hybrid so you understand it.
No, but that's while exactly we're here, it. Quite we're often the players not going to really
it's gonna make
know
make
what
difference.
They want.
They have no idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why coaching is important.
Well, Kevin, it's been an absolute pleasure. I know you've got to get on the range and out on the golf course. It's final day of preparation before the Players starts tomorrow. As we're here, the weather's not as I was hoping for on my trip to Florida. It's a bit cloudy, it's a bit damp. What are you expecting to see out there this week? And are there any little inside tips or players who you think this could really suit?
Golf course is probably as tough as I've seen it, and I've been here a lot. I think the rough is up much deeper than it has been in the past. The course is actually a little softer than sometimes it plays, just because we have. Yeah, but I expect the course this week to be a stern test. It looks like we're going to have pretty mild winds, but we will have a couple of days or probably 24 hours of wind. It's going to make this place very, very difficult. The winner this week will be a deserving champion, I will tell you. And I think anybody in this field can win.
In these conditions.
A lot of times around these courses, you can actually put your foot on the gas and tap and go really hard and be super aggressive. But this week, as deep as the rough is, if you get the ball out of position out of the fairway or going into a green, you're going to have your hands full, I would say, even though the greens are soft. So I think the ability to put the ball in play off the tee. The golf course is actually not a terribly difficult driving golf course. It gives you some room, right? But if you start hitting the ball in the rough or hitting it out of play, it's going to be difficult. I think the normal approach shots that the guys take here, I think are going to have to be tempered. I think you're going to have to think about this place more like a major, using the middle of the green, trying to approach them. Because if you do take on a pin, you get short-sighted. A lot of weeks on the tours around the world, it's not a big deal, but this week is a big deal. The green surfaces are going to be—they're all smooth and perfect as they normally are. So I don't think that's going to be a big deal. But I do think your ability to be mindful about getting the golf ball in play off the tee and how you're going to kind of
move
that golf
ball. So we're maybe not expecting 20 under.
Your approach shots are going to be—I think—are going to be the big things.
Okay.
Well, I would, if somebody shot 20,
well, we're looking forward
to
the weekend.
Skipping
Kevin, it's been a pleasure spending time with you this morning. Certainly look forward to watching out for your players on tour over the coming season. Any others you've got coming through?
You've always got kids in your developmental programs, and so I've got a couple of young kids that I'm kind of keeping an eye on. One of the kids that I've really got, I think, has potentially some really high top end. There's a young guy named Chase Johnson. He came out of Kent State and just getting himself kind of plugged in.
And they get going so quickly these days.
To
as well.
To the tour level kind of. It's amazing. Amazing. But anyway, there's always players that we're looking at out there. One of the things that we're doing actually in Doral that I'm excited about is we're actually setting Doral up as an international base for some of the foreign golf federations to try to support them and their players, so they can come in and do camps, so they can, if there's a player that's here in college or playing one of the tours and they need support in whatever form, we become an extension of the federation to try to support these players in the U.S. So watching some of these players from around the world, come in there and to be able to support the coaches and them and their journey is going to be super exciting for us. So that's, I'm excited about
looking forward to being with
the location we're going to be able
next
to
March, yeah. March 2023. And Kevin, thanks again and have a great week.
Thanks, Mel. And before we wrap up, I just want to thank you for all the things you do personally for all the people in the golf space. I know that you're a passionate guy about your work, and you look after everybody else's well-being, and you probably don't get recognized for that frequently enough. But I want to do that publicly
Kevin. Yeah, I guess
we love the game in a different
part of the game. And to be able to make a difference, and hopefully this sharing of knowledge is the way we make a difference.
Right,
thanks
mate.
Again.
Thanks for collaborating and try to leave it better than we found it, than we've done our work, right?
Absolutely.
Thanks for tuning into The Spin, brought to you by the Confederation of Professional Golf. Don't forget to subscribe, stream, and share this and all other episodes via the CPG website, cpg.golf. We all look forward to seeing you next time.